Omaha Public Radio presents a special program for National Child Abuse Awareness Month on Noon Forum. We'll hear the annual Speaking of Children lecture presented by Project Harmony. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday, March 11, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The guest speaker will be Antoine Fisher, Hollywood screenwriter, director, and film producer, and author of Finding Fish, a memoir. The film, Antoine Fisher, based on Fisher's life and written by Fisher himself, reflects on his life as a sailor in the United States Navy and as a child growing up as a ward of the state of Ohio, living in Cleveland. In his collection of poetry, Who Will Cry for the Little Boy, one of the best-selling books of poetry of all time, Fisher reveals the inner truths that took him from a tumultuous childhood to the man he is today. The title of his talk will be Antoine Fisher, A Story of Child Abuse and Resiliency. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Project Harmony, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Rhonda Hawks, honorary co-chairman of Speaking of Children.
Antoine grew up as a ward of the state in Cleveland, Ohio, and he overcame many obstacles to become an accomplished director, screenwriter, author, producer, and poet. There is no reason for us to tell you about his life when you can get that story firsthand. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Antoine Fisher.
And one thing I want to add, since we ask you to watch this movie if you haven't seen it, Antoine, would you help me remember, what is the name of this movie?
Antoine Fisher. It's a little indulgent. You know, when I originally wrote the screenplay and decided to call the film Finding Fish because my nickname is Fish, and I was in search of myself, and I found myself. And the studio told me that it didn't sound like a movie, that Antoine Fisher sounded like a movie. And I didn't think Antoine Fisher sounded like a movie. But I'm glad they named it Antoine Fisher because it gets me good tables at restaurants and gets me over sometimes. I'm here to help support and bring awareness to, first of all, bring awareness to child abuse and child abuse prevention and the need for the community to get involved in thinking about children and what they can do for children who are in need of help. Children who are being hurt and families that don't have the right expertise or tools to manage their families. And Omaha, in particularly, is fortunate to have Project Harmony here for a lot of different reasons. Yesterday, I went on a tour, and it was like the most inspiring place that I've been in all these years I've been going around the country doing this. The people who seem so dedicated, and the police officers and counselors, all in one building, it makes so much sense to me. When I was a kid, of course, there was social services, and of course, there was the police. I think the way people thought of a lot of when there were people who were having problems in their families, a lot of times it was left to the family to sort it all out alone. But now, you know, there are organizations like Project Harmony who work with families and work to protect children in this community. In Nebraska itself, it's pretty fortunate to have them. You know, we were all children. We've been children before, and you can remember how vulnerable you felt, and some of you can remember how protected you felt. You knew that there was someone who was going to be there for you, you know, your mother, your father, or your uncle, and there were people who you could talk to. Some children, when they emerge into the knowledge of themselves, they don't have any power, and they've been abused all their lives, and when they come into the knowledge of themselves, the abuse, sexual abuse, or verbal or physical abuse, is almost normal for them. And that's the way it was for me and my foster siblings when I was growing up. So I'll tell you a little bit about my story, and I'll try to illustrate how fortunate as a community you are to have Project Harmony here. I mean, you know, if you knew of a child that was being harmed, it would be hard for you, good people, to just be indifferent to it. And it goes on all the time, every day, even in this community. So I think that if you're looking for something to support and you want to reach out and help an organization that is really doing something that's going to help the community even in the future, because the children will grow up, and when they grow up, you want them to grow up to be healthy emotionally and to be able to contribute and even take your place so your community can go on and thrive. So they're not just children. There are the mayors or the police chiefs or the doctors and attorneys of Omaha's future and Nebraska, even America. You never know. I mean, when I was growing up, I would have never thought that one day I would be sitting in the White House in the president's apartment talking to his wife and him and talking to his mother and father. And I thought about all the things people said about me, that I would never amount to anything. And so these are the things that sometimes are harder for some children to overcome, what people say, what they do to them. So I'll tell you my story. I was born in a prison in Ohio. My mother was a foster kid, and she was 17. My father was a nightclub singer. He was 23, and he was murdered by a woman who he had two children with. Apparently, he was abusive, and she was tired of the abuse, so she killed him. So my father's family didn't know about me, and my mother's family, her real family, didn't know, because in those days, she wanted to keep it private, and so they did. I was born there, and they took me and put me in an orphanage, and then soon after that, I went to a foster home where, in my records, it says that the woman who had me, she kept me for 2 years, and I think those 2 years made the difference in my life, because the woman apparently really loved me. And as time went on, she became more agitated about the idea that the state would take me. She was worried that my mother would come out of prison and want to take me. She expressed this to social services, and so they were worried that it would make a parting of me and my foster mother difficult. So they took me and put me in another foster home that was a home where I stayed for 12 years, and they abused me and my foster siblings in every way you can imagine, and from sexual abuse to locking us in closets and leaving us tied in the basement for days, and verbal abuse. And for all the time this was happening, of course we didn't like it, but because it was happening for as long as we could remember, it seemed almost usual. And so we were able to tolerate a lot as children. And my foster sister, she was maybe 4 years older than me and my foster brother. She was enduring a different kind of abuse that I, of course, didn't understand. But as she was getting older, when she was 13, one of the family's friends had been raping her over time, and she told my foster mother that she was pregnant and explained what had happened. Instead of showing compassion, my foster mother beat her and blamed her for it. And because she didn't want social services to find out about it, she took her somewhere, and she got, of course, an illegal abortion. In those days, abortions were illegal. And her name was Valencia, and she told me it was the reason why she could never have children. And she lived to be 41, and she passed away, and always talking about our childhood and the abuse and how she felt. Some days she'd say that we had a great childhood. Some days she would tell me things that I had never heard before that she was experiencing. And she was conflicted about it all because she did love my foster parents, even though they were mistreating us. And because of the way they treated us, it seemed like it gave her whole entire family permission to treat us the same way. We were too afraid to tell the social worker. And one of the problems I had decided one day that I was going to tell my social worker what was happening. But the culture was not to be a snitch, because me and my foster siblings, we never told on each other. And so I felt like if my social worker asked me anything or led me down the road to telling what was happening, that I would tell her and it wouldn't be telling. And I was more afraid of my foster mother than I was of my social worker. So I, on a visit, she sat on the sofa and she was talking to me, and I was wishing she would ask me a question and I would give the answer that would make her want to ask me more questions. But the more I concentrated, even thought that I could control her thoughts and her speech by looking at her, it seemed like she would not ask me. And I think that was when I gave up thinking that I could get help outside of the house. So I just resigned myself to living my life the way I was living it, and that this was my lot in life. My foster brother, his name was Wayne, looking at how they treated him worse than they treated all of us, because he would fight them back. So they would tie him up and they would take they had this razor strap where my foster father used to sharpen his straight razor that he shaved with, and they would beat him with it. And he was the kind of kid who would say things back to them. And me, I wouldn't say anything. And as a result of that, they would beat him more. And then they made him mean. And so when they discovered that he was mean, they would, some of the family members would stick him on neighbor children, just like you would put a dog on another kid, have a dog fighting. And that's how he won his rewards for them. I remember him telling me when we were growing up that I was never going to make it because I wasn't willing to take what I needed, and life was not going to be kind to me because I was too soft. And so he started a crime spree when he was like 16, and it went on in Mississippi and Ohio, and ultimately he wound up in Lucasville State Penitentiary, where he spent the last 18 years in prison. And he got out last year, and I remember him calling me and telling me how afraid he was to get out and that he didn't have anywhere to go. And I told my wife, she said, well, he can't come here. So I had to hook him up in Cleveland with something, a place to live. And after all we've been through, I found my family, but my foster sister and brother seemed like my real family, the people who knew me. So we were living in this house. My sister Valencia, when she turned 18, my foster parents told her she had to leave, and they were not getting any money to keep her anymore, so she couldn't stay. Of course, she didn't know where to go, and she heard about Job Corps, and she went there, and then she went into the Air Force. I always thought that, we spent all of our childhood with them, and, I thought that there probably wasn't any love for us if they would be willing to let her go out into the street with no place to go, knowing that she didn't have a family. But they were willing to do that. In those days, they didn't have any organization that would help a kid who was coming out of foster care. My foster brother, he met his real mother, and he decided that he wanted to be with her. And so he would run away in the night to the part of the city of Cleveland where she lived, and the social service was worried about him leaving at night, and sometimes he'd be missing for days trying to find his mother, so they asked her to keep him. She kept him for about a month, And he went to school. One day came back and she had moved away and didn't tell him she was moving. So he was living in a house alone, in the apartment alone. And the teachers at the school came to the conclusion that it was unusual, his behavior and how he was behaving anyway. They called the police, and they investigated, of course, discovered he had been living alone for about 3 weeks. And so they put him in Boys Town, and this is when he started his crying spree. For me, I was the last kid there at the house, and my foster mother and father, they were getting older, but they had this big Victorian house in Cleveland. They wanted to fill the rooms up and to earn more money. And so this was when Vietnam was winding down. It was a lot of veterans who had issues, and they were in the state hospital. So she offered her house as to be a halfway house for those veterans who were able to live outside of the hospital. And so, of course, she brought them. There was about three of them that lived there, and I became the orderly, of course. And she had me dispensing their medication. You know, they had all this medicine they had to take, and it was my job. She bought me a watch, and, you know, this I was happy to have a watch, but, you know, I couldn't really tell time. And I discovered later in life that I was dyslexic. And, you know, I'm reading these labels and passing out medication to these grown men. It's probably a wonder they never got better. I remember how humiliating it was. It was a guy named Charles. I had to bathe him because he wasn't able to take care of himself. And I was 10 years old at the time. And it was really humiliating. And, you know, I get past that. I made a family out of my childhood friends and my teacher at school. Fortunately for me, I had the same teacher for 3 years in a row, and I really felt comfortable around her and safe, even though I was afraid to tell her what was happening, you know, over those years. But she was the kind of person she would ask. She would ask me. But by that time, I was so afraid of the foster parents that I would never tell her anything. Well, one day I came home from school. I was in junior high, I think the ninth grade, and my foster mother told me that she wanted me to go back where I came from. To make the story short, she told me to go back where I came from, and the only place that I had ever been was her house. So I didn't know where to go. She gave me 50 cents to take the bus and told me to put my things that I was going to take in a brown paper bag. And so I took the bag, and the following morning, I thought she would have changed her mind because she would threaten me, all my life threatening to send me back. But this morning, she was serious. I left the house with the few clothes that I took, and I was thinking that she would come running after me. And I got to the end of the street and to the bus stop, and I realized she wasn't going to come after me. And it was like after all that I had endured and kept quiet and the memories that I had that I could never get rid of even now that are really horrible, and the things I did to try to make myself appear normal to my friends, it seemed like it was all just not worth it. Like it was just all a waste of time, the whole 12 years or 14 years that I had been alive. So I went down to the social services office, and they took me in and put me in a orphanage called the Metzenbaum Children's Center. It was named after Howard Metzenbaum. I think he was a senator in Ohio. And I stayed there for 6 months. I was the oldest kid there, and they were saying that I should get some sort of counseling because they said I was a walking pressure cooker, and they were worried that I would explode in an unprotected environment, and that that I should receive this counseling right away. Well, they also told me that no one was willing to take a teenage boy, so they didn't know where I could go. And so they offered this reform school in Pennsylvania called George Junior Republic. So they took me for a visit out there, and, you know, since nobody wanted a teenage boy and they were willing to take me and I couldn't stay at the orphanage, I told them that I would stay at the reform school. And I stayed there till I graduated from high school. I actually liked it there because no one was hitting on me, no one was molesting me, no one were calling me names. I think that I did gain some self-esteem there. And when I graduated, my social worker came and told me that the state were going to make me an emancipated minor, and so I would have to take care of myself, and they were going to take me back to Cleveland, and he was going to leave me at a shelter. So he took me to the men's shelter in Cleveland, and this place had all kinds of deviants there. So I knew from my growing up to watch out for people. I didn't trust adults, and certainly in this place I couldn't trust anybody. And someone told me that to be careful because there were men raping boys. There were other boys who were there who were foster children as well. I wasn't, you know, they were former foster children. So I was being very careful. One night I went to the restroom. The restroom was outside of my room down the hall. And these two guys caught me. So I escaped the building by making my way down the stairs into the alley outside. And in this building, once you go outside at night, once they close the building, you have to stay outside. So I spent the night in the alley that first night, and I had on pajamas, and nobody wore pajamas in this place. And so I came back in the front door around 10 o'clock when they opened the doors, maybe 9, and there was a lot of people in the lobby, and they were asking me, where was I coming from? And it was a guy, his name was Butch. I knew his name from people talking about him and seeing him around. He asked me what had happened to me, and I told him. And he said, oh, I'll take care of those. I know exactly who you're talking about. And he asked me, what was I doing there? And I told him that I didn't have anywhere else to go, and the state left me there. And they had given me like $65 and some meal tickets to eat at a diner that was nearby. So he said, well, I'll take care of those guys, but you're going to need to fix your situation. And I thought, wow, I was happy that somebody was taking an interest in protecting me and with some guidance. Well, he gave me a job, and the job was collecting money from the prostitutes who worked for him. And he taught me how to roll joints. You know, this is where I was left. And it was like Oliver Twist. And I wasn't like the only kid there. So sometimes when you see kids who are left from foster care and they go out into the street, these are the people that they meet. There are people who are out there who know, and every June, kids are going to graduate from high school. And some of those kids are foster kids who don't have anywhere to go, girls and boys. And every year, there's a new crop of children who will show up on the streets with nowhere to go, who are looking for some protection and for some guidance. And I always say, like, if you were a girl, like, God have mercy on you, from my memory of those days. And if you're a boy, even that, depending on the kind of boy you are, you might survive. It's not like this where you come in for dinner and lunch and get to sit around with a tie on. It's horrible. And pimps and drug dealers, what they called back then hustlers, they were all out there. And some of them were women and would take advantage. And they were just, it was like when people look for, companies look for the new money at the end of the fiscal year. These people are looking for new people. Sometimes they lose prostitutes to decency, so they need new people. And children are the best because they don't know anything, and you can train them. Well, he had me selling also these cards. He had addresses on the cards, and he said that the cards were for people who wanted an extra special time. So I thought maybe these addresses were the people who would provide this extra special time was. So I had this regular customer who would come and get a card from me. Like every 2 weeks seemed like it would be his payday. And I would sell these cards. They were $300. Sometimes I would have $2,000 on me just walking around the city. And I was a kid who had never had $5 of my own before. And so I was, sometimes I would have marijuana on me. And I was a kid who had never been around any of that. Well, my regular customer didn't show up to get this card. And he had instructed me to sell all the cards to this one individual who had given me almost, I guess it was about $900 or a little over $1,000 for the cards that I had. And the next day when I gave Butch the money, the card was with it. And he asked me, why was the card there and why didn't I sell it? Did the guy not want the card? I told him, no, I had a regular customer that didn't show up. And before I could even finish, he started beating me. He must have beat me for like 5 minutes. And all the people who were claiming to be my friend who worked with him and for him just stood by and watched. And I was thinking, like, somebody, one of these adults is going to stop him. And I probably should have gone to the hospital if I was smart enough to know to do that. And I couldn't understand why he got so upset. He told me he was going to make sure I became a good businessman. And so I asked a girl named Rhonda who worked for him, why'd he get so upset? And she said that some drug addicts were exchanging their kids with him for heroin. And the kids were at these addresses where deviants would come and have sex and take pictures of the kids. That's why he got so upset. It was his money, she told me. And so after all of that, I had been through growing up. I knew exactly what that must have been like. And I couldn't believe that I was a part of that unknowingly, but still I was a part of it. I felt even worse. I don't think I ever felt that bad. So I decided I had to leave there, the shelter and all those people. So I went back to the shelter and got whatever clothes I thought I could take, and I knew that they would be looking for me. So there's a place where the Cleveland Orchestra plays. It's called Carnegie Hall, and it has a beautiful park. And I remember when I was in my elementary school class, we would go, and the school would provide us with a field trip there, and I always liked that park. So I went, and I lived in that park for about a week, and I started shoplifting for food and asking people for quarters. I was 17 at the time, and I thought that maybe I could get help if I went back to the neighborhood where I was a foster kid. So I went back there, and I ran into my friend Jesse, and I explained my situation to him, and he said, oh, you can live in my basement. Or you can live with us. My mother, she won't know. You know, his mother had like 8 children. And you know, he said she wouldn't know. I remember one day I was watching television and she came. You know, she worked all day. No, she worked all night and she slept most of the day. And I was watching television. It was just me and her in the house. And she stopped and looked at me. And I was like, oh, no, this is it. So I did like, so maybe I'm yours, maybe I'm not. Anyway, the summer seemed like it was unfolding like beautifully, you know. And Jesse was my friend and I was running into more friends that I had grown up with. And one day I was at the schoolyard playground playing basketball with some friends, and Jesse came and said, hey, come to the store with me, and I'll buy you a soda. I said, oh, when I get done, I'm going to be done in a minute. He said, okay, just catch up with me. So the game was over, and I walked up the street, and just in time to see, well, I was standing at the stoplight to cross the street, and I saw Jesse talking to an older guy, and you know, Jesse was always arguing and, you know, bullying people. And this particular guy, I suppose, well, obviously that day he wasn't in the mood for it. He shot Jesse and killed him. And, you know, of course, I've seen a lot at this time, but I'd never seen anybody get shot. and shot and killed. When you watch it on television, as I was a kid growing up, it didn't seem as final as all that, but it was another horrible event that happened, and I didn't know what to do. Of course, I couldn't go back to his house or try to explain. I didn't want to be a witness or anything, so I just took off, and then I just had what I had on. In the summer, it was an Indian summer that year, 77 in Cleveland, and I was thankful for that because I was homeless, really homeless then, and I was depressed, and I was despondent, and I was afraid of what was to come. So I was afraid to, not so much to live, but I was afraid to go on. Like, I felt like, it was just getting worse. And then I was, of course, I was too afraid to die. But it was a really confusing time. And then winter turned to fall, and I was still outside, and I was living in the storefronts. And that was another experience. And then it started to get cold, so adults started to coming into the storefronts. And so I started sleeping outside. And the nights were the worst. I would stay awake all night, and I would sleep periodically during the day. And it was really a bad time for me. I hadn't had a bath in like months. I hadn't eaten like in a normal way. And I was really depressed. Then, to make the story short, it started to snow. And of course, I couldn't go in the storefronts. And I started sleeping in the snow. I had stolen a coat from Cleveland State University. I would hang around there because there were other kids, even though I didn't look like them. I was jealous that they had a life. I remember I took this coat off the back of a chair, and I was so happy to have it. And I actually felt like it was mine. I felt like I deserved to have it. And I figured out how you could stay warm sleeping outside, warm as you could be. And every piece of article, of course, that I had stolen from someone. One day, I was walking down the street to move the story along, and I saw this sign that said, "Join the Navy and see the world." So I said, I checked my schedule. Nothing pressing to do. So I went in to the office, and it was 2 days before Christmas in 1977, and I was explaining to the recruiters that I wanted to join the Navy, and they told me, "Well, if you come back after the first of the year, we can help you. We're going to go on, we're leaving to go on a Christmas vacation," or they were leaving for the holiday. And so I told them if they didn't take me, I was going to join the Army. Because the Army never closed, not even on Christmas. So they said, "Oh, we wouldn't let that happen to you. You've had it rough enough, apparently." So they gave me an aptitude test, which when they told me I had to take a test, I was so terrified because I was always told that I wasn't smart. And I thought that, wow, I'm not going to make it. But I did pass the aptitude test, or I took it, and they said, okay. And they got me a room at a Holiday Inn downtown Cleveland. And I took the longest bath of my life. And then I took a shower, and then I took a bath, and still there was dirt on me. I'm not just saying that. It took a while to come off. And I wasn't scrubbing hard enough the first couple of times. They're probably still cleaning that tub out. Well, they came and got me early that morning and took me to the federal building, and they gave me the other tests and physicals that I needed. And that evening, they gave me a wrapped package and a ticket, told me to go to the airport and how to do it, and to take a plane to Chicago, where I would be at boot camp at Great Lakes, Illinois. And I thought that, wow, you can't let me just go on the airplane by myself. I was thinking, you know, I'm a kid, can't you see? Well, this is my first experience with the Navy requiring you to do things you probably thought you could not do. And so I was learning to be responsible for myself. And so I did go through boot camp, and I never failed a test or a physical test or academic test. And I remember being in the drill hall graduating from boot camp, and I was thinking, I wish somebody could see me, you know. After all, you know, I had accomplished a lot just getting through boot camp, I felt, because I was fit, I wasn't hungry. The clothes I had on was just like the other 2,000 kids who were in there, and I thought that if someone looked at me, they wouldn't be able to tell that I had the kind of growing up that I did. So I thought that this would be a good beginning, a new beginning for me, that I could, like, reinvent myself, and I would not tell anybody of my former life, and that I could, like, recreate everything. And so I entered, and I spent 11 years in the Navy, and I really did enjoy it. I think I enjoyed it more thinking back. It was a lot of hard work. One of my friends from the Navy, Scott right here. Raise your hand, Scott. He was my boss. And one of the great people that I met while I was in the Navy, I became a patriot. Somebody who, you know, after you travel with the Navy and all the ceremonies and everything you learn about America and as it relates to yourself and other countries, you know, being an American, what that means, I came to really love the country that I was from. And being proud to be an American, the Navy gave me so much. And the ability it was rough in the beginning, but to learn how to get along with other people and to learn how to talk about my problems, I learned how to do that in the Navy. I learned responsibility and to not be afraid. And when you are afraid, it doesn't mean that you have to stop working. We worked hard in the Navy. Isn't that right? We worked hard. I mean, I remember the first day I had a chief petty officer who used to always tell us we were going to work till dark 30. And I was like, what the hell is dark 30? It was like a half an hour after it gets dark, and we'd still be working. And he'd tell you this early in the morning, you know. And then when, after a while, time goes by, and you're the one that's telling people that they're going to be working to dark 30, you become a part of the organization you were trying to destroy. And I tell you, the Navy is a hard organization to destroy. I tried. It's like, bring it on then. So I got so much out of the Navy, and I thought to myself that I had never been on my own. I never have taken care of myself. It always had been some government agency that was taking care of me. Social welfare, or it was the juvenile justice system, or it was the U.S. Navy. And I thought that, you know, I wasn't afraid anymore. The Navy had filled me up with self-esteem, and I was, you know, a proud person, and I loved myself, and I understood a lot of things about life that I had a misunderstanding about earlier. I had gone to see a naval psychiatrist who spent a lot of time working with me, trying to put my growing up in perspective, and I learned to really respect what psychiatrists do. And I would say, you know, people, they're not ashamed to go to the hospital when they have a broken arm or when they get sick or they get a cold or when they need a dentist, but people refuse to accept that you may have a emotional injury that you need to talk to someone about, a doctor, somebody who's trained to talk to you. And I found out in the Navy that psychiatrists and psychologists have a lot to offer in the way of helping you figure out how to heal yourself. And you know, these things never go away. You know, they're always a part of your life, just like happy times are a part of your life, and that times where people don't want to forget. Well, the bad things that happen, the things that are unfortunate, they're part of your life too. You just have to figure out how to put them in perspective. And in the Navy, I learned how to start doing that. And even now, you know, as you grow up and even become an adult and a parent, after coming through life the way I have, you realize that not just the medical doctor or a dentist should be a part of your family group of doctors. You should have a family psychiatrist who might be able to help you in your family, even to give advice or help you to figure out how to navigate through times that are difficult emotionally. I think because people feel like if you do go to a psychiatrist, that it means that you're not in control. And to not be in control means that you're weak or you are in some way you're inferior to other people, or that it's embarrassing. I think, you know, if I've had a broken arm before and I felt weak, I felt out of control, I felt like the same feelings. So I wasn't ashamed to go to a medical doctor. So I keep saying this and talking about that part because I really feel that, you know, all of us can benefit from unloading. And sometimes we behave the way we do and we don't understand why. Sometimes we don't even know that we're behaving in the way we do, but it's easy to see. And sometimes people accept your behavior because they love you and they just put up with it and wouldn't dare tell you you need to see a psychiatrist because most people get insulted. But, you know, this is a real thing. So I spent 11 years in the Navy. I felt like I was strong enough to get out and I was going to take care of myself. I was I wasn't afraid at all. I mean, I had the attitude like, why did I stay in so long? But, you know, the day I left, I was so happy. And looking at the ship and leaving the base, I was thinking like that had been my life since I was 18 and I was 29. And I thought that I didn't really appreciate the Navy as much then when I was getting out as I do now, and thinking about all that I got out of the Navy. And I've certainly got a lot out of me because they work hard, you know. But and I always say this, if I lived for 1,000 years, I would never have the chance to thank the Navy enough for all that I got out of it and for all the different members that I met while I was there, what they gave to me to be able to move forward with my own life. So I went to the Federal Law Enforcement Academy in Glencoe, Georgia, and became a federal correctional officer, and they stationed me at their prison at Terminal Island. And this was another chapter. I spent 3 years as a correctional officer, and I was transporting inmates from Long Park Penitentiary to MDCLA and then Terminal Island. And it was like really scary for me. And I thought that I had met all the wicked people in there. And this was a whole new group of wicked people that I met. And I thought to myself that this doesn't suit my personality to do this. So I heard that Sony Pictures was hiring security guards, and I thought that I could be a security guard for a little while till I figured out what to do next. And I went to Sony, and when I got there, you know, it was kind of like working at Disneyland because there's a lot of interesting things that go on there. And, you know, I was there just to have a place to be till I got myself together. And then this is when I started looking for my family. In the movie, I find them while I was in the Navy, but in reality, I found them after. And so I hadn't been there long to acquire any leave. So my boss wanted to know why I wanted to go, and I told them. So I went to meet them, and it's the strangest thing, you know, when you get off the plane, and then the people who are your family that you've never met, you get off the plane, and you come out into the waiting area, and all the people who were there, it was like the Wizard of Oz. They were all the people that I knew growing up, because my uncles and his children lived two streets down from where I lived, with the Foster family. And I had another uncle who lived in the neighborhood, and they remembered me, of course. And I was so close to them, and I would walk by my grandfather's house every day going to walking to junior high school. And, you know, rather than think about what could have or all of that, I've learned to sum it all up as it probably was meant to be. And so since I made it through that time, I thought not to torture myself with that. You never know. I could have had a worse life, you know? Well, anyway, I came back from visiting with them, and while I was there, my uncle, my father's brother, found my mother. He had a friend named Jesse Fisher, and he said that, I'm going to call Jesse and see if he knows anybody named Eva, because he didn't know. And so he called Jesse, and Jesse said, well, I have a sister named Eva. And so he said, well, there's a kid here who says, you know, apparently he's my brother's son, and he says his mother's name is Eva. And then Jesse said, well, bring him over here and let me take a look at him. So that's how black people do DNA tests. Got to get the oldest person in the family to take a look at you. So he looked at me, you know, and then he nodded and said, yeah, that's one of them. So we went over to her house, and he asked her, he says, Eva, who is this right here? And she looked at me, and she said, oh, that's Johnny. He said, no, that's Antoine. That's Antoine Fisher. And then she fainted. You know, you see people faint in the movies? They faint, and it's like they got shot. Like they just drop, you know? She had never seen me before, except for the day I was born. And that was like 33 years prior. So I thought, you know, as a kid, you always have these things in your mind about the things you would say if you ever saw her. In the movie, I have the character saying all these things, you know, to her. But when I saw her and in her condition, I thought that, you know, you never know. Her life could have been worse than mine or have a tougher life than I did. So I just thought that I should not say anything to upset her, you know. And, you know, by this time I had grown to and came to the idea that, you know, family is really where you find it. Sometimes friends make better family members. Some people, like my foster brother, even though he's a criminal, I guess I love him anyway. And he's my brother. And so I thought that maybe I should spare her, you know, any speeches. So I just gave her a hug when they got her up and, you know. And so we never really hit it off. We tried. You know, we're both really different, and we didn't have any history to base anything on other than just her being my mother. My teacher, Ms. Prophet, who I talk about in my book, is more like the mother that I to me, and she's like the grandmother to my children. And so I've met so many wonderful people in life, and I've had so many different kinds of experiences and times. I think I've had a really full life, and I think, you know, when I came back to Los Angeles and I went onto the lot, Daddy DeVito wanted to see me, and he asked me to tell him my story, and I told him. And then there was other people, and I thought, wow, maybe if it would make for a good movie, maybe I should have a part in it, not an actor, but maybe I could write it. And everyone kept saying no, because I hadn't been to college and didn't have any writing experience, and that they would hire a screenwriter to write it. And so I just said, well, I don't want to do it. But the idea that I could do something and change my life, and by then, every time someone told me no, that I couldn't do something, I thought that I owed it to myself to at least try. So I went to a Walgreens and got some legal pads and started writing my story by hand. And I knew this producer who would come on and off the lot, and I asked him, would he read it? And I gave him all these handwritten pages, and he was looking at me like I was a security guard, and he was giving him a script that was handwritten, and he was like, all right, whatever. But he did start reading it, and he called me and told me that he thought I had writing talent and that I should quit the job as a security guard and meet him at the Fox lot on a particular day. So I met him on the Fox lot, and he took me to his bungalow of offices, and he said, "This is your office right here, and that computer is the computer. We're going to teach you how to write a screenplay." And so they were paying me to write my story. And I, of course, apparently I had writing talent, but I didn't know how to write a screenplay. And so they taught me. And because I had learned that sometimes when people are offering you an opportunity, you have to do everything you can to show them that you appreciate what they're doing for you. So before he sold it to 20th Century Fox, I had written my story, different versions of it, 41 times. And even I didn't think about the different drafts until I was done doing it. And I was thinking, I mean, I couldn't even type at the time. So you see, two fingers, I was doing these 120-page screenplays. It took me 6 months to do it. I would work day and night, not to let him down because he was offering me an opportunity. And then 20th Century Fox bought it from me. And since then, I've written 16 screenplays and movies for the studios. Some of them were made, some of them not. Movies like Rush Hour and Money Talks. And I always think of those first because I had the most fun on those. But and directing films. And writing books. And it hasn't been easy because while I was in the Navy, I was diagnosed as being dyslexic. And I wasn't, you know, they explained what it was. I was so happy to be dyslexic because I realized, wow, I wasn't stupid. You know, so I came back and, you know, this had been my life for the past 17 years, writing movies, speaking on behalf of children and writing books and, you know, still developing as a person, still trying to find, you know, we all still trying to find our way through life. And, you know, we have children now. I have two children. And to think about my life and what I endured and to think about my children and see them, you know, it's almost imaginable. It is imaginable, but I know that it's true because I endured it. How horrible it is that a kid will have to grow up so fast or become an adult or look out for the others or, you know, be molested and be told that you're never going to amount to anything. I think that to have an organization like Project Harmony would have made all the difference for so many kids in Cleveland when I was growing up because I wasn't the only kid. Everywhere I ever was, there were always other kids there, and I didn't have it the worst. There were some stories that I had heard, and I was grateful for my life and my story. So if you are looking for a organization that's here in Omaha that you can reach out and touch and that you could be a part of, and or you could donate to your time or your talent, I went there. There was a room full of, like, blankets, and it was, like, caught my eye. And even something as small as that could make a difference to a kid, not even a small child, but even a teenager. You know how vulnerable it is to be a kid and have no power at all. And so, you know, we are all children at some point in our lives. You have to think about that and not to be indifferent to it all. And there are police officers and social workers, psychiatrists and psychologists and counselors are working hard every day. They get up knowing that they're going to hear another horrible story. The police have to arrest somebody and not knock them in the head for what they've done. They have to be restrained and have to be professional when they know this person has done this to a child. These are people who have to get up in the morning and not go to Sony Pictures or go work at some amusement park. There's a lot of dangerous people who prey on children, like I was when I was in the street in Cleveland. And, you know, Omaha is a nice place, but, you know, every city has their under city. and the police and social workers and people who work and volunteer at Project Harmony, they have to deal with that side of it too. These, you know, we're all decent people here. And there are children who are smashed in the middle of the indecent people and us, and the kids need us. So whatever you can do, you have to help. So thank you for listening to me. Oh, thank you. Thank you. When I was 16, when I was living at the orphanage, the orphanage arranged for me to talk to a counselor. It was when I first started thinking about my life, and I wrote this poem called Who Will Cry for the Little Boy. It wasn't as elaborate as the poem was as it was in the movie, but when I went to the Navy and I was seeing the naval psychiatrist, he asked me if I would write something to express how I felt. I told him I liked to write poetry, so he asked me to write something. And I remembered that poem that I had written when I was 16, and I wrote it for him, and he really loved it, and asked me if he could keep it. And so when I wrote the book and the movie, I put the poem in the book and the movie because of him and because of what it meant to me when I was a kid. So I think I remember it. So I'm going to recite it for you. It's who will cry for the little boy lost and all alone? Who will cry for the little boy abandoned without his own? Who will cry for the little boy? He cried himself to sleep. Who will cry for the little boy he never had for keeps? Who will cry for the little boy? He walked the burning sand. Who will cry for the little boy, the boy inside the man? Who will cry for the little boy who knows well hurt and pain? Who will cry for the little boy he died and died again? Who will cry for the little boy, a good boy he tried to be? Who will cry for the little boy who cries inside of me? So that was the poem.
You've been listening to a special program for Child Abuse Awareness Month on Noon Forum. We've heard the annual Speaking of Children lecture presented by Project Harmony. The guest speaker was Hollywood screenwriter, director, and film producer Antoine Fisher. The title of his talk was Antoine Fisher, A Story of Child Abuse and Resiliency. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday, March 11, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Ann Weitz of Project Harmony for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. This has been the first of two Noon Forum programs with Antoine Fisher. The evening before the lecture you just heard, Omaha's Film Streams Theater presented a special screening of the 2002 film Antoine Fisher, directed by Denzel Washington. Following the film, there was a special question and answer session with Mr. Fisher. 2 weeks from today, on Monday, April 27th at 12 noon, we will present that question and answer session in another special Noon Forum program. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.